A sloth, a donkey, and a curious human send a prompt and see what they're doing. One hits record with a question on his mind. Two brothers pick it up, see what they find. Corn takes his time, Herman's got the facts. Back and forth, they never hold back. My weird prompts, come on in, that's where we begin. My weird prompts, glad you're here.
This episode was generated using artificial intelligence. Please verify facts.
Well, Herman, we are sitting here on the 11th of March, 2026, and it feels like the world has fundamentally shifted under our feet over the last 2 weeks. Our housemate, Daniel, sent us a fascinating prompt this morning that really cuts through the noise of the headlines. He wants us to look at the data behind Operation True Promise 4, which has been unfolding right in front of us since the 28th of February. It is a staggering amount of information to process, especially while we are living through the sirens and the interceptions here in Jerusalem.
It is a massive task, Corn. I am Herman Poppleberry, and I have been glued to the open source intelligence feeds for the last 11 days. What Daniel is asking for is a comparative analysis between what we are seeing now and Operation True Promise 3, which most people remember as the 12-day war back in June of last year. And I have to say, the numbers coming out of the open source datasets, especially the ones being compiled on platforms like GitHub, are absolutely unprecedented. We are looking at an evolution in warfare that is happening in real time. To put it bluntly, if True Promise 3 was a major regional escalation, True Promise 4 is a full-scale industrial military campaign that has redefined the boundaries of the theater.
It really has. I mean, just looking at the raw volume is a good place to start. In True Promise 3, we saw about 1,700 munitions over 12 days. That was already considered a massive escalation at the time, a real test of the regional air defenses. But now, in True Promise 4, we have seen roughly 5,970 munitions in just 11 days. That is more than a 300% increase in volume in a slightly shorter time frame. We are talking about 2,410 ballistic missiles and roughly 3,560 drones. The sheer scale of the logistics required to launch that many assets is mind-boggling.
And we have to lead with a heavy disclaimer here for our listeners. This is all based on open-source intelligence. We are talking about satellite imagery, news reports, social media captures, and public announcements from various ministries of defense. The numbers are disputed, the wave boundaries are often blurry, and the claims from the Iranian side versus the Israeli and American sides are frequently at odds. We are looking at a partial data set, but even that partial view reveals a very clear tactical shift. We are using the structured data set from Daniel's GitHub repository as our primary anchor today, but we acknowledge the fog of war is thick.
Right. We are not military generals. We are looking at this as data analysts trying to make sense of the patterns. And the first pattern that jumps out at me is the tempo. Herman, the pace of these strikes is relentless. In the 12-day war, we were looking at maybe 1.8 waves per day. In this current operation, we are averaging nearly 4 waves every single day. That is 41 documented waves in 11 days.
And it started with a literal bang. The opening 24 hours of True Promise 4 featured 9 distinct waves. That is an unprecedented initial barrage. It suggests that Iran has solved a lot of the logistical bottlenecks they might have had a year ago. To launch 9 waves in one day requires a level of coordination, launch site readiness, and command and control stability that we just did not see in previous operations. It is not just about having the missiles, it is about the ability to cycle through the launch sequences without the sites being neutralized or the crews becoming exhausted.
It makes me wonder if this is about more than just causing damage. You and I have talked about this before, but it feels like a diagnostic stress test. If you are firing 4 times a day, you are not just trying to hit a target, you are trying to see how long the defense can hold its breath before it has to come up for air. You are looking for the breaking point of the integrated air defense systems.
That is a great analogy. It is a test of the interceptor inventory as much as it is a test of the radar systems. If you look at waves 16 and 17, that is where the combined arms evolution really becomes apparent. This was a masterclass in saturation tactics. They sent in about 230 attack drones. Now, these are relatively slow, easy to track, but they are numerous. They saturated the air defense environment for 3 hours. And then, just as the defense systems were dealing with that massive swarm, they followed up with over 40 advanced ballistic missiles targeting command infrastructure.
So the drones are essentially acting as sensor blind bait. They force the Iron Dome, the David Sling, and the Patriot systems to engage, to use up munitions, and to keep their radars locked on these low-priority targets. While the crews are focused on clearing the screen of 200-plus drones, the high-speed ballistic missiles are timing their arrival for that exact moment of peak saturation.
Precisely. It is a sequencing tactic. In True Promise 3, the sequencing was much simpler. It was usually just drones and missiles arriving around the same time in a single pulse. Now, we are seeing a 3-hour gap that seems specifically designed to catch the defense in a reload or recalibration phase. It exploits the physical limitations of how many targets a single radar can track and how many interceptors a battery can fire before it needs a fresh magazine. It is a much more sophisticated use of different weapon classes to achieve a single tactical goal.
And the weapon classes themselves have leveled up significantly. I was looking at the timeline of the escalation ladder Daniel pointed out. The first 9 waves were mostly standard stuff, the Shahed drones and the older Imad or Gadra missiles. But then, by wave 10, they introduced the Khyber Shakan with maneuvering warheads, specifically targeting government complexes. And then, wave 12. That was the big one, right? The first combat use of the Fatah II hypersonic glide vehicle.
That was a milestone, Korn. We have to distinguish between a standard ballistic missile and a hypersonic glide vehicle like the Fatah II. Traditional missiles follow a predictable ballistic arc, like a ball being thrown. Hypersonic glide vehicles are a nightmare because they can maneuver within the atmosphere at speeds exceeding Mach 5. They do not follow a predictable path, which makes the intercept calculation for systems like the Arrow 3 incredibly difficult. And then, just to keep the pressure on, by Wave 19, they brought out the Khorramshahr 4. We are talking about a missile with a 1-ton warhead. That is a massive increase in destructive potential per successful hit compared to the smaller warheads on the earlier models.
It feels very deliberate, like they are walking up a staircase. They start with the cheap stuff to see where the sensors are active. Then they use the maneuvering warheads to test the agility of the interceptors. Then they use the hypersonics to try and bypass the defense entirely. And finally, they bring in the heavy hitters once they think they have found a gap. It is a logical progression of force.
And we cannot ignore the geographic expansion here. This is one of the biggest differences from the 12-day war. Back then, it was almost entirely focused on Israel. This time, the data shows strikes or attempted strikes across 12 different countries. We are talking about Bahrain, Kuwait, Qatar, the United Arab Emirates, Saudi Arabia, Jordan, Oman, Iraq, Cyprus, Turkey, and even as far as Diego Garcia in the Indian Ocean.
That is a huge shift in signaling. Striking at United States bases in the Persian Gulf, hitting the United States Embassy in Riyadh, the consulate in Dubai, and even reaching out toward the middle of the Indian Ocean to Diego Garcia. That is a clear message to Washington. It is Iran saying that this is not just a local skirmish. They are willing and able to target the entire regional infrastructure of the United States. It is an attempt to deter American intervention by showing that no base is out of reach.
It is also a tactical move to dilate the defense. If the United States and its allies have to worry about defending bases in 5 or 6 different countries simultaneously, they cannot concentrate all their Aegis destroyers or Patriot batteries around a single theater. It forces a fragmentation of the integrated air defense system. You are making the defender choose which high-value assets to protect, which inevitably creates gaps elsewhere.
I noticed that the targeting changed around Wave 20, though. Early on, it was this broad, multi-country spread, but after Wave 20, the focus seemed to narrow back down primarily to Israel. Why do you think that happened? Is it a matter of running out of the long-range stuff, or was there some sort of strategic recalibration?
It is hard to say for sure without better intelligence, but the data suggests a few possibilities. It could be that the initial wide-ranging strikes were a demonstration of capability, a way of saying, we can hit you anywhere, so stay out of this. Once that point was made, they narrowed their focus back to their primary adversary, but we also have to consider the possibility of munition exhaustion for those specific long-range platforms. Even a country like Iran, which has a massive domestic missile industry, has limits on how many high-end, long-range systems they can fire in a single week, or perhaps diplomatic back channels led to a de-escalation in the broader region while the core conflict continued.
That makes sense. But even as the geographic focus narrowed, the nature of the targets within Israel became much more aggressive. In True Promise 3, it felt like they were mostly aiming for military bases and sparsely populated areas to minimize the risk of a total war. This time, we are seeing a systematic targeting of energy infrastructure. The Haifa refinery, the oil terminals in Fujairah, power stations, airports, and communications hubs. It is a shift toward economic warfare.
And the human cost has been different too, even if the total casualty numbers are currently lower than the 12-day war. We are looking at 14 killed and over 2,300 wounded so far. Wave 9 was particularly devastating. An IMAD ballistic missile hit a residential area in Beit Shemesh. 9 people died in that single event. That is the highest death toll for any single strike in this entire operation so far. It highlights the inherent danger of these large-scale barrages, even with a high interception rate. If just one missile gets through and hits a high-density area, the results are tragic.
It also brings up the issue of cluster munitions. This was a major point in Daniel's prompt, and something we touched on in episode 973. Around wave 20, the Iranian side started deploying cluster warheads on their Kbar Shaken missiles. There is this haunting visual that people have been calling the shimmering curtain over the night sky.
It is a terrifying development from a civilian perspective. We discussed the technical side of this in the episode titled The Shimmering Curtain. Instead of one warhead hitting one point, the missile releases hundreds of submunitions over a wide area. In Wave 35, for instance, we saw a single missile dispersing its payload across multiple neighborhoods, from Yehud and or Yehuda to Holon, Bat Yam, and Rishon LeZion. It turns a precision strike into an area denial weapon. It makes the job of the emergency services almost impossible because you have small unexploded boblets scattered across entire city blocks.
It feels like they are moving away from the idea of precision being the only goal. If you cannot guarantee a hit on a specific building because the defenses are too good, you just saturate the entire neighborhood with submunitions. It increases the probability of hitting something valuable, even if it is at the cost of much higher collateral damage. It is a brute force solution to a high-tech defense problem.
Precisely. If you look at the progression, they tried the high-precision maneuvering warheads, they tried the hypersonics, and then they integrated the cluster munitions as a way to ensure that even a partial interception or a near miss still has a significant impact on the ground. By Wave 27 and beyond, they were using the Khorramshahr 4, the Fatah 2, and the cluster warheads simultaneously. That is what military theorists call a multi-vector, multimodal attack.
I want to go back to that diagnostic war hypothesis you mentioned. If you are Iran, and you have just fired nearly 6,000 munitions in 11 days, what have you learned? You have seen how the Israeli and American systems respond to different tempos, different altitudes, and different weapon types. You have mapped the gaps in their coverage. You have essentially performed a live-fire audit of the most advanced defense network in the world.
You have also tested their logistics. We know that interceptors like the Tamar for the Iron Dome or the missiles for the Arrow system are incredibly expensive and take time to manufacture. By sustaining 4 waves a day, Iran is forcing their opponents to burn through their inventory at a rate that might be unsustainable in a long-term conflict. It is a war of attrition where the munitions being fired are much cheaper than the munitions being used to stop them. If Iran can produce 10 drones with the cost of one interceptor, the math eventually breaks the defender.
That is the part that worries me. If this is just a diagnostic phase, what does the next phase look like? If they have identified the weaknesses in the regional air defense through this massive output in Operation True Promise 4, they might be saving their most effective tactics for a future escalation. They have mapped the sensor blind spots and the reload cycles.
That is the big question. Does the narrowing of targets toward the end of this week suggest they are winding down, or are they just focusing their remaining high-end assets on the targets they now know they can hit? The fact that they are now simultaneously using their most advanced tech suggests they are trying to create the most complex problem possible for the defense to solve. They are overwhelming the decision-making process as much as the physical interceptors.
It is a lot to take in. I mean, we are living through this, and hearing the sirens and seeing the interceptions. You realize that the data we are talking about represents real lives and real danger. But looking at it through this analytical lens is the only way to understand the strategic shift. We have to look at the patterns to see where this is going.
It really is. And I think it is important for our listeners to realize that this is a fundamentally different kind of conflict than what we saw even a year ago. The scale, the variety of weapons, and the geographic reach are all telling us that the old rules of engagement are being rewritten. Iran is demonstrating a capacity for sustained, high-intensity operations that many analysts previously thought was beyond them. They have moved from a doctrine of sporadic retaliation to one of sustained industrial warfare.
Well, the logistics alone are a huge takeaway. To be able to launch almost 6,000 munitions in 11 days tells me that their domestic production and their supply chains are much more resilient than people gave them credit for. You cannot do that if you are just relying on a small stockpile. This is a massive shift in doctrine, which we actually explored in episode 945, The Ring of Fire.
And it is worth noting that they are doing this while under significant international pressure and sanctions. It shows a level of strategic depth that is quite remarkable. They have built an asymmetric capability that can challenge even the most advanced defense systems in the world. They are not just firing missiles, they are managing a complex multi-theater campaign.
So, where do we go from here? If you are looking at the GitHub dataset and the latest open source intelligence reports, do you see signs of this cooling off, or are we just in the lull before Wave 42?
The data is mixed. The frequency of waves has slowed down slightly in the last 48 hours, but the intensity of each wave has remained high. It could be a transition phase. But honestly, with the introduction of things like the FATA 2 in actual combat, we are in uncharted territory. We do not know what the long-term effectiveness of these systems will be once the defense has had time to analyze the data from these interceptions. It is a constant game of cat and mouse.
Every time the offense finds a new way to penetrate, the defense finds a new way to block, and then the cycle repeats. But the sheer volume of data being generated in this conflict is going to be studied by military academies for decades. It is the first real-world test of hypersonic glide vehicles and large-scale drone missile sequencing.
And for those of us watching from the outside, it is a reminder of how quickly the landscape of modern warfare can change. We went from True Promise 3, being the gold standard of drone and missile attacks, to True Promise 4, making it look like a small-scale rehearsal. The geographic expansion alone, bringing the conflict to the doorstep of Europe via Cyprus and into the Indian Ocean via Diego Garcia, has changed the political calculus for every global power.
I think that is a good place to start wrapping up this part of the discussion. We have covered the tempo, the weapons, the geography, and the tactical sequencing. It is a sobering picture, but a necessary one to understand the world in early 2026. We are seeing a shift from regional skirmishes to a multi-theater, high-precision escalation ladder.
It really is. And I want to thank Daniel for sending in this prompt. It forced me to dive deep into the numbers in a way that I think really clarifies what is happening outside our window. If you are listening and you want to see the data for yourself, I highly recommend checking out the open source repositories that are tracking these waves. It is a fascinating, if somewhat grim, exercise.
Definitely. And before we go, I want to say to our regular listeners, if you've been following us for a while and you find these deep dives helpful, please consider leaving us a review on your podcast app or on Spotify. It really does help the show reach more people who are looking for this kind of detailed analysis. We are over 1,000 episodes in, and your support is what keeps us digging through these datasets.
Yeah, we really appreciate the support. It keeps us going, especially when we are spending our nights poring over satellite imagery and missile telemetry. It is a community effort to make sense of a very complicated world.
You can find all our past episodes, including the ones we mentioned today, like episode 945 on Iran's strike doctrine and episode 973 on cluster munitions, at our website, myweirdprompts.com. We have a full archive there, and you can also find our RSS feed for your favorite podcast player.
We are also on Spotify, so you can follow us there to get every new episode as soon as it drops. We will be keeping a close eye on the situation here in Jerusalem and across the region, and I am sure we will be talking more about this as the data continues to come in.
One last thing, Herman, before we go. I was thinking about that strike on RAF Akrotiri in Cyprus. That is significant because it brings the conflict into the doorstep of Europe. Cyprus is a European Union member, even if the base is a British sovereign territory. It adds a whole other layer of diplomatic complexity. It is not just a Middle Eastern conflict anymore. It has direct implications for European security.
Precisely. And that is another reason why this operation is so much more significant than True Promise 3. The geographic expansion has changed the political calculus for everyone involved. It is a global event, not a regional one. The signaling to the United Kingdom and the broader European Union is just as clear as the signaling to the United States.
It really is a lot to chew on. Thanks for sticking with us through the extra thoughts, everyone. It is just the kind of topic that keeps you talking long after the sirens have stopped.
It really is. Stay safe, everyone. Keep looking at the data and stay curious.
Thanks for listening, everyone. We will talk to you soon.
Take care, everyone.
Goodbye.
Goodbye.
This episode was generated using Gemini Flash 3. Text-to-speech engine was Chatterbox.
Thanks for listening to our show, my weird prompts, where our thoughts go from slow takes to facts on cue. We change and follow through my weird prompts. That's the close from slow.